Hi, I'm Anne Strangechamps. It's to the best of our knowledge, and I want to play a sound for you. See if you can guess what this is. Here's a hint. I'm at the zoo. I'm standing in the ape house at the Brookfield Zoo in Chicago, looking at and listening to a family of unbelievably noisy white-cheeked gibbons. So this is a mom, a dad, and three sons. It's lunchtime, and they're swinging wildly from branch to branch, huge, graceful, swooping leaps, and the whole time they're making this unearthly noise. Now, I don't know if the gibbons are singing to each other or yelling at us or what. And it's that unknowability of wild animals that draws us to them. Most of the time, seeing them in a zoo is about as close as we can get. But animal scientists and naturalists are coming up with a few new ways. For instance, ever wondered what it's like to be a badger? Try living in a hole in the ground and eating worms.
When you put a worm into your mouth, it senses the heat as something sinister. You'd have thought it might make a bid for freedom by going down into the deeper darkness that usually means home and safety and head for your esophagus. But it doesn't. It goes for the gaps between your teeth. It thrashes, whirling one end like a centrifuge around the middle of its body. It lashes your gums. Eventually, frustrated, it curls up in the moist space next to the frenulum and considers its position. If you open your mouth again, it'll be off, pressing its tail against the floor of your mouth like a sprinter pushing off from the blocks. This is all disgusting. When you bite into a worm for the first time, you expect the sort of performance that every angler knows, twisting, questing against the hook. But it doesn't happen. Even if, like me, you can't bring yourself to mash the worm with your molars and instead nip it genteelly with your incisors, the main action is crushing. And that seems to be different. Crushed animals just lie. It doesn't seem to hurt. Anyway, both ends of the worm capitulate. And then I can move the worm back and chew it.
This is from one of the most remarkable books of the year, Being a Beast, by the British naturalist Charles Foster. Eating worms, it turns out, is what you do if you are trying to live like a badger, along with digging a hole in the ground and getting in it. Steve Paulson was deeply intrigued, and thank goodness he asked what we are all wondering.
So what did the worm taste like?
Worms taste over the land, unsurprisingly. And they vary according to, as the wine people would say, the terroir.
You mean worms from different areas will taste different?
Yeah, it's unsurprising. They take in earth into their bodies and take the bacteria off those particles. And so you'd expect them to taste of the earth. And so they do. And their slime seems to taste rather different from the body itself, mysteriously, and changes with the seasons.
Now, most people who did something like this would have a really strong visceral reaction of disgust. And, you know, it would be really hard, frankly, for a lot of people not to throw up. Did you have to deal with that kind of thing?
Of course. Yeah, I don't like doing this, but it was more interesting than it was disgusting. Because I had no idea what the land tasted like, and I rather want to know what the land that I walk over tastes like.
So Charles, I mean, the larger project is to try to become like an animal, various different kinds of animals. And so for the badger, you went to the point of, you know, digging a big burrow in the ground. You slept there for weeks on end. In fact, you took along your 8-year-old son. What were you trying to figure out here?
Well, I disagree with your description of what I was trying to do.
Okay.
I wasn't trying to be any of these animals. There's a big mistake. There are many mistakes in the book, but there's one big mistake, and it comes right at the beginning. The first line of the book is, I want to know what it's like to be a wild thing. In fact, I don't know anything other than what it's like to be a wild thing, because you and I, however polite and however metropolitan we are all wild things. We've been shaped in the course of our evolution by wild influences. And why do we like sitting by a fire at Christmas time? It's not because we have romantic Dickensian ideas or are smelling the roast chestnuts. It's because at some level of our subconscious, we feel more secure knowing that we can take a brand out of the fire and shove it into the face of the wolf which we're expecting to come. So we are all wild things. So what was I trying to do? I was trying to acknowledge those wild influences on me. And I was trying to see the landscapes that I love in the way that the creatures that know that landscape much more intimately than I do perceive it. Normally, when I go into a wood, for example, I don't see the wood properly and I don't hear what's going on because of all the cognitive tinnitus, which is buzzing in my head.
Right. I mean, sometimes, I mean, for instance, going back to the badger, I mean, what you did when you're in the your own burrow, your sort of badger-like hole, is you're there in the darkness. The most dominant sense that we have, vision, is sort of inoperable at that point. You got to do some other things then.
Right. And you didn't even have to be in the burrow to realize that a badger's vision is relatively unimportant to it. If you just drop the 6 feet from your usual level of seeing the world and the 30 million years down to the time when we last shared evolutionary ancestors with the badger, you will find yourself on the floor of the wood and your eyes will be pretty useless. So you will immediately need to engage senses other than your eyes, senses like olfaction, senses like hearing, senses which we have in a perfectly satisfactory way, but which we dismally underuse. So we are pathetically under-sensual creatures. We normally use only our vision and we translate what we see into abstraction. So normally when I'm going through that wood, I'm describing not what the wood is like, but Charles Foster's thoughts about the wood, which are hugely less interesting than what the wood is really like. And I think that's a criticism which applies to lots of nature writing, which is essentially colonial. We come into the wood, we stride manfully into it, and we bring into it all our preconceptions about what that wood should be like. And when we write our nature books, we're describing the contents of our own heads. Very, very boring.
Yes, but can you really do anything else? I mean, when you get right down to it.
You can take steps to do a little bit better. Just sniff and feel, just like children do. I watch my children playing, and you could be forgiven for thinking that humans aren't meant to be bipeds because they're constantly on their hands and knees, physically pushing a lot more of their flesh against the ground than I do when I stride across the world. And they sniff and they hear that they've lost so much less than I have in their contact with the world.
Well, and I got the sense, I mean, reading your chapter on being a badger or being sort of somewhat like a badger, that, you know, you were there with your son Tom, who was 8 at the time, and
right.
he seemed to be a better badger than you.
Hugely better, and therefore a much better perceiver of the wood. So he saw the wood much more accurately than I do. He doesn't have all those distorting lenses on when he looks at the wood.
So tell me a little bit about sort of the other senses that kicked in for you. I mean, for instance, smell. I mean, did you develop a more acute sense of smell?
I don't think I developed a more acute sense of smell. I think I became better at paying attention to smell. So our sense of smell is really pretty good. You know, quite a high proportion of us can, for example, detect our own worn T-shirt amongst other worn T-shirts that are presented to us. So just as in all other areas of life, as soon as we start paying attention to things, we notice them. Why are we satisfied as humans with simply being visual animals, with subjecting ourselves to the tyranny of the cognitive? It's just less satisfactory than acting as a human on all the cylinders that we have. Mm-hmm. So why just be a visual animal if you can be an olfactory one and an auditory one as well? It's not being less human to try to use all your, if you want to put it like this, God-given faculties. It's being more human. I just want to challenge us to use all the apparatus at our disposal.
Now, there are some kind of big philosophical questions that you are exploring here. One of them is whether we can really get into the head of another animal. Can we cross that divide between species, you know, that otherness? Because a lot of people say it's impossible. And there's a famous essay by the philosopher Thomas Nagel, What Is It Like to Be a Bat? And he concluded, we will never know. What do
Right.
you think?
I don't think the sort of exercise that I undertook tells you anything at all about animal minds. I think it tells you something about landscape, and I think it tells you something about yourself. So it teaches you something about the relationships with the wild that shaped you, I think you can learn to be a more intelligently self-comprehended human from crawling around in a wood or rummaging through a dustbin if you're trying to be an urban fox. But I don't think it tells you anything really about animal minds.
Yeah. Now, we've talked about your efforts to kind of be badger-like. There is another animal that would seem to be so far from what it means to be human that you couldn't even imagine sort of being anything like it, and that's the swift.
Right.
You know, the bird that can apparently stay in the air without ever touching ground for 3 or 4 years. I mean, to the point, you know, they eat, they mate, they sleep in the air for years on end.
Right. So the swifts which hatch in the eaves above my study in Oxford will go perhaps 4 times to the centre of Africa, to the Congo, without touching anything more solid than the carapace of an airborne beetle in all that time. They won't perch. As you say, they will sleep by spiralling up in the thermals. Yeah, they are part of the air. They graze on these shoals of aerial plankton which are carried up from the ground. And the attempt to become one of them is ridiculous, almost blasphemous thing to suggest. So, as in the case of all these animals, now, I wasn't trying to become them, but I was trying to see the world as they see them.
So how do you attempt to try to see the world from the swift's point of view?
Well, you can try various things, paragliding, climbing to the top of trees, where the top of which, or around the tops of which, the swifts are feeding. You can try, as I did, to map the swirls of air which are carrying all the insects up from the forest floor. You can try, as I did, manically following the swifts on their migration across Europe and into West Africa. But all those things really just remind you of what a lumpen, earthbound creature you are. You know, the buckles tug at your crotch. You're fearful of falling off the top of the tree. They just remind you of the massive gulf between you and this piece of air with wings, which a swift really is. So it became a more poetical exercise, really, than anything else.
Charles Foster's book is called Being a Beast, Adventures Across the Species Divide. He talked with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. I mentioned that I was at Chicago's Brookfield Zoo recently, and one of the things that I noticed when I was there is that what we all of the visitors, really liked best is when the animals did something human-like. For instance, the daily bird demonstration, where the star of the show is a bright blue parrot named Happy Jack.
Well, what do you think of our audience? Yeah, we got a good-looking audience, but, you know, he does think pretty highly of himself as well. Are you handsome? You handsome? Yeah, he's a pretty bird. He does actually know a little song. Do you guys want to hear that song?
Yeah.
All right, Happy Jack, let's sing.
I left my heart in Peru.
Where?
In Peru.
Nice job. Can you tell everyone goodbye?
See you later. Hasta la vista, baby.
Hasta la vista, baby. That was Jack, our yellow-headed Amazon parrot.
So I know this is basically a party trick. I mean, I don't think Happy Jack really means what he says, though I don't know, how do I know? But this does say something about how much we wish we could really talk to the animals. The British naturalist Helen MacDonald writes a lot about the interactions we humans have, or try to have, with wild animals. A few years ago, she wrote a book called H's for Hawk. It's a memoir about taming a wild goshawk. She named it Mabel. The book was a huge hit in the UK and here. Helen was back doing another round of book talks recently, and she and I got together to talk about her life after Mabel.
Well, Mabel's become a superstar.
You know? I know, she
has. When I wrote the book, I didn't expect this to happen, but people coming up and sort of saying, you know, oh, you know, she's still around, and I'm saying, no, she's not, but I still have this, a lot of her old malted feathers in a vase on my desk, you know. Oh. She died very suddenly a few years ago of a horrible fungal infection, but yeah, Mabel was a superstar, and people really, really love her.
So these days, I've read you have a parrot, though.
I have a parrot now, it's true. This makes me laugh. My friends have constantly been telling me it's emotionally more healthy to have a parrot because it's cuddly, right? Mabel was lots and lots of things, but she was never cuddly. And I always come back and say that, you know, I've had more scars from my parrot.
Really?
Than I ever had from my hawk. Because although hawks are very heavily armed, they're incredibly honest emotionally. You know, they're very simple beings. They're very solitary in the wild. So if you upset a hawk, it just gets upset and then it forgives you. If you upset a parrot, you're in trouble. Because it's going to come and get you, right? So when I occasionally upset my parrot, it bites. And yeah, there's a lot of bites. And, you know, I love my parrot. I'm having said that, it's a wonderful creature.
But
it's like living with a person more than a bird. It's called Birdle. You know, Birdle. It just happens.
So I read somewhere you wrote that your parrot is actually vindictive.
Yeah. It can be vindictive. But, you know, everyone can. So, but I think, you know, parrots.
But how so? What does it do?
Oh, it'll remember and get me back later.
Tell that story you told somewhere or other. I can't remember where I read it. The one about the parrot and your mother. She was trying
to feed it. Oh, the lentil. Oh, this is so funny. This is classic, right? My mum and the parrot got on so well. And then one day I went out and my mum was sort of, the parrot's out of the cage all the time, you know, and it was wandering around the sort of table. Mum was having a lunch and she had a lentil salad with vinaigrette on the lentils. And the parrot loves lentils. So she offered one to the parrot, which came over and took this lentil and then went, ew, you know, because it was vinegary and spat it out. This was fine. My mother made the mistake of then picking up the same lentil and offering it again. And the parrot came up, took the lentil, and it was still disgusting. And it dropped it and just stared at her like, what are you thinking? And then walked towards her and bit her very, very hard. And that was the end of their relationship. It was terrible.
Does the parrot still not like her?
Well, no, I think what's happened is that my mum's quite scared of the parrot now. And, of course, the worst thing is now that my mother's scared of the parrot and the parrot knows this and the parrot thinks this is hilarious because all it has to do is walk towards my mum looking threatening and my mum will back away. It's heartbreaking.
But I have to say, so I'm listening to this. You're an expert naturalist, you're a scientist, this sounds like gigantic anthropomorphization, doesn't it? Like,
but
you're attributing all these emotions to the parrot.
Of course,
which maybe
I am.
It doesn't have.
I think anthropomorphism is an incredibly interesting thing, and I kind of am worried about the way that it's just routinely dismissed. I kind of believe animals run on emotions. And parrots are particularly interesting like that. I mean, I think this wonderful kind of slightly animistic term of non-human person is perfect for a parrot. These are creatures which live in social groups like, you know, like sort of apes and monkeys. They're very intelligent. They've discovered that some species of parrots give their young chicks names in the nest.
Really?
I mean, scientists call them individual identifiers, but basically names.
But it sounds.
Yeah, it's little sequences of chirps and chips, which the birds will elaborate on, maybe, but they use that name all their lives, and they use it to signify each other when they're calling each other.
Wow.
So I think, you know, how can I not anthropomorphize that parrot, you know? I mean, they're people, they're just not human.
So it sounds like one of the things you're suggesting is that we've created this false dichotomy where between our human world and the quote-unquote wild world. And increasingly, the story we tell about the wild, of course, is the ways in which we humans have ruined it.
Yeah.
And maybe as a result, we think the most moral position to take is to stay the hell away from anything wild and away from wild spaces, lest we ruin them all anymore.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a very strange situation we find ourselves in. You know, we're basically living through the sixth great extinction right now, you know, caused entirely by us. The world's getting quieter and sadder and more empty all the time. And we're taught that nature is precious. It is. And we're taught that nature, we shouldn't touch it. And I think that's very dangerous. I really
Why?
Do. Well, in lots of ways. You know, for example, in England now, there's a kind of small salamander called the great crested newt, possibly the first time the great crested newt has ever been mentioned on this radio station. And it's very rare in Europe, but it's quite common in England. And it's so protected that it's actually illegal for people to put their hands into a pond and drag one out to show their kids. Or
it's illegal even to touch one.
Yeah, yeah. You're not supposed to disturb them at all. And I remember going to a conference once, and this guy in the audience put his hand up and said, "What's the point of protecting them then, basically, if we can't touch them or see them?" And there was an uproar, right? But of course, these animals have intrinsic value for themselves and for their systems. But he made this point and he said, no one's going to want to protect or anything or save anything if they have no knowledge of it whatsoever and they've only seen it in pictures and they can't viscerally go and see it and touch it and learn to love it in the real world. And I've never forgotten that, you know.
I don't know if you've ever seen a wild animal in an urban space, but I've, you know, been walking down my neighborhood street at an odd hour and seen a fox suddenly run across the street, mm-hmm. or once seen a coyote suddenly run across the street. And it's a pretty amazing experience when you see an animal that you think shouldn't belong in your section of the world.
Right. And particularly if they look at you as well. There's been a lot written about the animal gaze. You know, sort of John Berger writing about the fact that we usually observe animals. The fact that they can observe us seems to have been forgotten. So certainly when you come across a fox or an owl and it turns its head and looks right at you, there can be moments of real confrontation with your idea of yourself, you know. My most kind of common experience of a very wild animal in an urban setting are peregrine falcons, which, you know, back in the day there were hardly any left because of DDT and shooting, and now they're these really familiar inhabitants of built-up cities, and they live on skyscrapers, and I've talked to people who've said, you know, they've been sitting in their office and they've turned and there's a peregrine falcon sitting on their windowsill looking right at them. And the number of people who've said to me, it was like a religious experience. Here I was in this mundane office, and suddenly there was this wild creature staring right at me. And I felt like I'd been sort of singled out for some special, almost sort of sacred moment. It's really interesting how that happens.
But say more about what you think that is.
Well, that's a lot of things, I think. And partly it's that we don't expect to see wild creatures, very wild creatures, close up, let alone in our office windows looking right at us like the boss is staring through, you know. But also, I think a lot of the wild creatures, like wolves, like hawks, they've had millennia of significant social, religious and mythical meaning for us. And I think those stories about them are still there. We still have carry them sort of bubbling along inside, deep down.
Red Riding Hood and the wolf.
Right. Yeah. So when a wolf looks at you or a falcon looks at you, some part of you, you know, knows that there's some significance there, which might be more than just, here's a bird on my windowsill, right? If it was a chicken, it would be a different situation.
Well, and to bring us full circle back to what we've lost when we try to make a very clear, sharp boundary between us and the wild, it cuts off that movement, that extension of empathy and sympathy between us and the non-us, I guess is what you're saying.
It does, and it makes the world a lot smaller and less. It lessens it for us, I think. And I know it sounds, I'm sort of saying things that make it sound like it's all about us, but when you surround yourself by things that are like you, and you're in that sort of bubble, the human bubble, and you don't love difference, you love things that are like you, I think that's a great, great shame. And I think a lot of the sadnesses in the world come from that movement of wanting to just be surrounded by yourself. So yeah, I get out there. Get out there and watch the spiders and the sparrows in the puddles and, you know, enjoy the wonder of the world.
Helen, thank you. It's a pleasure talking.
And you, I've had a great time.
Helen MacDonald is the author of H is for Hawk and a collection of poems called Shaler's Fish. And meanwhile, back at the Brookfield Zoo, the lions are hungry. The most uncomfortable moment for me at the Brookfield Zoo was at the lion enclosure. There's this huge male lion that came right up to the glass. I mean, he was just inches away from us, and he started pacing back and forth, back and forth.
Wow. Yeah. Look how funny his paws are.
That's pretty impressive.
And there's some little kids and their mother there, and the lion at one point just stops, and he stares right at them, unblinking.
look at him start teeth. Mommy!
I thought, yeah, the lion's looking at you, and he's thinking, hello, lunch.
Maybe he's hungry.
Maybe he's hungry?
Yeah,
I think
he's looking at you.
Oh, yeah, he just licked his chops.
How do we ever know what animals are thinking? For that matter, have you ever noticed how often we compare animal intelligence to our own? I mean, there's a whole cottage industry of lab studies suggesting that chimps have the learning ability of a 2.5-year-old human child. There's Rico, the border collie in Germany, who can recognize 200 different words. There's an African gray parrot named Alex, who could say 100 words. But, you know, maybe human intelligence is the wrong yardstick. Primatologist Franz DeWaal told Steve Paulson he thinks it's pointless to try to rank who's smarter and who's dumber in the animal world. The title of his latest book says it all. Are we smart enough to know how smart animals are?
We have this scale in our mind of higher animals and lower animals, and of course we are at the top of that scale, and we have been comparing us with other species. And I personally must say that the question whether you are smarter than an octopus, yes or no, is really not an interesting question, because in some ways, of course, you are much smarter than an octopus. In other ways, the octopus can do things that you certainly cannot do. You can change color in response to its environment. That's a cognitive feat right there. And so lots of animals do things that are quite complex.
So you're saying that animals, other animals, I mean, other than human beings, have very different kinds of intelligence than we do.
Yeah, so if we compare with chimpanzees, we are comparing at sort of the same level, because a chimp has manual hands and has binocular vision. And so a chimp is very similar to us. But how are you going to compare yourself as an elephant, I don't know, or a bat or an octopus or a dolphin? These live in very different environments, perceive things very differently from you. And so their cognition is also very different.
Well, there's a fascinating history here of how scientists have tried to draw the line between humans and other animals. I mean, what is it that only humans do? And at one time, it was thought to be tool use. There was also the idea that it was self-awareness. Or later on, the idea that we were the only species that could pass down our culture to later generations. Mm-hmm. But it turns out that various animal species can do all of those things.
Yeah, there's really not much of a claim that has held up. So we have come up over the last 50 years with maybe 25 different claims. Theory of mind is another one. And none of this has held up. And that's why in the book I ask people to stop doing this. Stop making these outrageous claims of we are the only ones who can do this. Why would we want to focus on these differences that turn out to be illusory? Yeah.
Well, I think the reason people do want to focus on these differences, I mean, other than a certain amount of, I don't know, hubris about what it means to be human, mm-hmm. is that we have put our imprint on this world like no other animal. We have a certain level of sophistication in our culture that no other animal has, right?
Yeah, that depends on how you look at it. If you mean like we fly in airplanes and we have the iPhone, yes, that's very special. That's a sort of accumulation of human knowledge that has happened in the last couple of hundred years. And so it's not a single individual human who has invented the iPhone. The iPhone is an invention of the human species through its scientific communications, basically.
So you're saying the mistake is if we try to look at the human brain and compare it to the brain of any other species, we're not fundamentally different than other species.
Well, the brain issue is sort of interesting. It got exciting when at some point neuroscientists proposed that we should not look at brain size and we should not look at body size. We should just look at the number of neurons that's in the brain to determine how intelligent the species is. And all of this was fine because at that point, humans had the most neurons of anyone. And so this held up fine until 2 years ago, I believe, it was determined that the elephant has actually 3 times more neurons than the human. And at that point, everyone got very upset and said, well, how is that possible? These neurons are probably sitting in the wrong place at the elephant or whatever. So they came up with alternative explanations. But this is what happens all the time, and I got sort of tired of it because many animals do wonderful things with their intelligence in their particular environment.
Well, let's talk about culture, because for so long it seemed that Okay, culture was the one thing that humans had that no other animal species have. But even if we're just talking about chimpanzees, I mean, there are certain cultural traits or cultural knowledge that's passed down among certain groups of chimps that other groups don't have, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so the concept of animal culture came from a Japanese scientist, and I don't think it is accidental. It came from Kinji Imanishi. Because in the West, the anthropologists had defined culture as human. So they said, culture is what makes us human. Now, within that framework, there's no room for animal culture, for sure. So it was not an accident, I think, that a Japanese scientist was the one who said, well, if animals can learn from each other, they learn habits and knowledge from each other, and as a result, they produce different groups of the same species that act differently, we should call that culture in animals.
Well, let's give some examples here. For instance, there are these Japanese macaques that wash potatoes.
Yeah, so that was discovered in the 50s, is that the scientists were handing out sweet potatoes to macaques and they would take them to the ocean to wash them. And it was a young female who started it, and from her it spread to all sorts of other individuals. But now we have, in chimpanzees, at least 50 or 60 behaviors that vary across Africa. So you can show to a primatologist a little video of chimpanzees, let's say, eating nuts or whatever they're eating, and he can, on the basis of behavior alone, tell you where that video was taken.
So, for instance, certain chimpanzees in West Africa smash nuts with rocks, but you never see that behavior in East Africa.
Yeah, so that's a specialization in that area, and who knows how it got started. It has been going on for thousands of years. They recently excavated a site where chimpanzees have been cracking nuts for 4,000 years. And so they have said chimpanzees have entered the Stone Age. That's how they call it.
And then there are chimps in the Congo, I know, maybe other places as well, that use different kinds of sticks to basically get army ants out of their nests. I mean, there's the big stick and the little stick.
Yeah, so the chimps use toolkits. And I'm very interested in that because it relates to planning. So if they're, for example, going to raid a beehive, they have a stick to perforate the beehive and another stick to scoop up the honey. They usually have three or four different sticks. And they need to do all of this quite quickly because the bees, of course, get angry and they have to get out of the way at some point. And so they come to their task with a whole bunch of tools, the way you would come with a screwdriver and a hammer or whatever. And the planning capacities of apes, because that takes some planning to do that, is a topic of intense study at the moment. So we tend to think of animals that they live in the present. Animals don't have a future and don't have a past, so to speak. But we now do all these studies where we have animals, we give them, for example, in experimental settings, we give them tools that they cannot use until a couple of hours later and see if they hold on to the tools.
Oh, and also, aren't there cases where chimpanzees, maybe other species as well, will hide certain bits of food so that their friend, across the prairie or whatever doesn't see it, but then they'll come back and get it. I mean, there's a whole deception factor going on here.
Well, the deception is, of course, anyone who at a zoo who works with orangutans know that, for example, orangutans can dismantle the whole cage without you knowing. So they unscrew every screw, they put it in their mouth or they put it in a hiding place, and so the caretaker has no clue what's going on until, of course, the whole thing is taken apart. I heard such an interesting story out of a Swiss zoo where the orangutans had a skylight in their cage, and they had dismantled the whole thing. And on summer nights, they would spend on top of the roof of their building. And then in the morning, before the caretakers come, they would go back into their cage and put that skylight precisely back so that no one ever noticed. So they may have been doing it for years, they said, before they noticed what was going on.
So it wasn't just a matter of just wanting to escape, get out. They came back in and put the skylight back in.
Yeah, no, it was not an escape thing. It was more like on a nice summer night, it's better to be on the roof than inside, of course. Yeah.
But I mean, it also raises a fascinating question about when you get to the animal species that are so unlike humans, like dolphins, let's say, that live in an entirely different kind of environment. How do we begin to try to understand their cognitive abilities?
Well, dolphins have very complex vocalizations. So one of the things with dolphins is they have called signature whistles. So each individual has its own melody, a bit like the ringtone of a telephone. Each one has a different ringtone. And they recognize each other by these sounds, but they can also, and that's really interesting, they can call each other by the sound. So you can call me by using my sound, you imitate my sound, and you're directed at me, and I know that my name is being called.
You're talking about being directed to an individual dolphin, not just a whole group of dolphins.
Yeah, to an individual. And so the dolphin experts talk about names. They say it's not just a signature whistle. They use it as a name that they can call someone by, and they use their signature whistles as names for each other.
Wow. Just because dolphins are so, I mean, yes, they're mammals, but they live in an entirely different kind of environment. I mean, an aquatic environment. Will we ever really understand how dolphins think?
I think with dolphins, we will get closer than, with, let's say, with fish. Fish live in that same environment, and octopus live in that same environment. And we have much less of a connection because everything that mammals do, like mammals have cooperation going, have empathy going, have mother-child bond. And so in many ways, mammals are the animals we can relate to the easiest. But try to relate to fish behavior or try to relate to octopus behavior, that's all very challenging.
And the octopus in particular, which we know is highly intelligent and has most of its neurons actually in its tentacles, right? Not in its brain.
Yeah, so the octopus has more like an intranet instead of a centralized nervous system. And so it's all spread out and distributed. How can we ever relate to that? Is that I don't know how the octopus perceives things, but we know that their little brains are sort of mini brains that are sitting there. And we have no way of knowing how complex that kind of cognition is at this point.
Now, it would seem that maybe if there is one attribute that humans have that, for the most part, other animals don't have, it's language. Would you agree with that?
Well, that's the one exception I make in my book is that language is the one capacity where I say, well, that's probably a human specialization that is really something that we have.
But then it raises this fascinating question about for those animals that basically don't have language or just a very rudimentary form of language, what does it mean to think without language?
I'm not sure we use language to think. This was at some point very popular. But of course, Piaget, who studied young children, he already objected to it. He felt young children think, but they don't have language yet. And so we now don't believe that language is the stuff of thought. We are now at a stage where we look at the specific ecology of the species to understand what kind of cognition does it have. So, for example, there are wasps that recognize each other by their face. It's very remarkable.
Really?
Because face recognition.
Individual wasps.
Yeah, so face recognition used to be considered uniquely human. That's completely abandoned as a position. But then the wasps came, and they found one kind of paper wasp that lives in small colonies where the individuals have a hierarchy, and so it helps them to recognize each other. And they have different patches, yellow and black patches in the face, and they recognize each other's faces. And there's a very closely related wasp that doesn't live in that kind of tight, small family units, and they don't recognize each other, and they cannot recognize each other by their face. And so cognition is very much dependent on your ecology and your natural history, and that's something that the behaviorists completely overlooked because they try to equalize all cognition across the board.
Franz de Waal is the director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. He talked with Steve Paulson about his book, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? It's to the best of our knowledge. From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
My name is Jennifer Jacquet. I'm an assistant professor at NYU's Department of Environmental Studies, and I'm the author of Is Shame Necessary? New Uses for an Old Tool. I want to recommend today a book published by Douglas Adams and Mark Cowardine in 1990 called Last Chance to See. Mark Cowardine is a zoologist with the World Wildlife Fund, and Douglas Adams is our old friend who wrote Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and is best known for his science fiction, but actually wound up writing this fabulous book about seeing some of the world's most endangered animals. The book is part travelogue, part natural history, and partly a treatise on the extinction crisis. He travels all over the world to Indonesia and New Zealand and Zaire, which is now called the Congo, and even China, looking at the rarest species in the world. The best part about Douglas Adams is that he really never addresses anything head-on. He tackles this really sad problem that we're faced with, which is the high rate of extinction, in this really beautiful and funny way that makes you, in the end, realize that he's sort of as depressed as you are about the whole thing, but refuses to sort of let it get him totally down. So here's a part where he's about to visit the gorillas. The gorillas were not the animals we had come to Zaire to look for. It is very hard, however, to come all the way to Zaire and not go and see them. I was going to say that this is because they are our closest living relatives, but I'm not sure that's an appropriate reason. Generally, in my experience, when you visit a country in which you have any relatives living, there's a tendency to want to lie low and hope they don't find out you're in town. At least with the gorillas, you know that there's no danger of having to go out to dinner with them and catch up on a million years of family history, so you can visit them with impunity. I love lines like that. Unfortunately, since he wrote the book, the Yangtze River dolphin, which he does feature, has been declared extinct. When he wrote the book in 1989, he was on the trip. There were 22 northern white rhinos, and today there are only 5, and they all live in captivity. So it really was his last chance to see. I am really interested in the idea of survivor guilt, but at a sort of species level, and it's something I myself really grapple with, feeling like humans are causing the extinction of so many animals, and we're going to survive and they're not. And I really look for writers who kind of feel this way too. And this book, by far, really got to that point. It's one of the best treatments of what I would describe as survivor guilt there is.
Jennifer Jacquet recommends Last Chance to See by Douglas Adams and Mark Cowardine. You can find more bookmarks and an interview with Jacquet on our website at ttbook.org. Could you have survivor guilt about an animal you've never seen and that might not even still exist? In 1992, in the remote wilderness along the Laos-Vietnam border, two biologists found the horns of a previously undiscovered animal, a large, they think ox-like, creature called a saola. Now, as you'd expect, the discovery of a brand new mammal rocked the science world. But the thing is, to this day, no one's actually seen a saola in the wild. So it could be extinct. Conservation biologist William Robichaud set out to find the saola. William DeBise joined him and wrote a book about their quest called The Last Unicorn, and they never did find it. But as Robichaud told Charles Monroe Kane, they did find much more.
That was extraordinary. I've been following and studying this animal for about 15 years, and I've only ever seen it once, and that was a captive who actually didn't live very long. It's extraordinarily beautiful. It's scientific genus name is Pseudo-Oryx because it superficially looks like the oryxes of the Middle East and North Africa, with beautiful white spots on the face and very long horns, about 2 feet long. It's actually a very primitive member of the cattle family. Basically, there's only one species of saola in the world, and it's the saola.
It's the only thing left in its species? That's it?
Yeah. It was only discovered by the outside world in 1992 in Vietnam, and it was probably the most spectacular zoological find of the 20th century. Not even biologists in Hanoi knew about it, only local villagers, until it was discovered by a biological survey team in 1992.
Doesn't that surprise you? I thought you could find a new frog, maybe, or a new plant form, or an insect in Brazil, but a mammal?
This was not like finding a new species of deer or a new right. species of raccoon or something of that sort. This animal, it's its own genus. It may be its own tribe taxonomically. It's like it's so evolutionarily unique. It's like the coleanth, you know, the mystery of the seas.
So you guys went to see it, right?
I tried. I looked at the little inset map in the article that showed where it had been discovered in this little national park in Vietnam on the Lao border, and I said, that thing's in Laos for sure. And within like 2-3 days, I sort of took a bus, half hitchhiked, down to that forest on the Laos side of the border and just walked around for a few days. Didn't see a Saola. Still haven't seen one, but it was, yeah, he had to do it. And it was confirmed to occur in Laos just a couple of months later. It's endemic to the Annamite Mountains, which form the border of Laos and Vietnam.
So incredible. William, I have to ask, in your book, this becomes mythical for you, and I can see why the more I talk to you. And you start referring to the Saola in a sense, as a unicorn. Why?
Well, the animal itself is enigmatic and elusive and very beautiful. And it came to stand in my mind, and I think also in Bill Robichaud's, as a kind of crystallization of beauty in nature. And so our hunt for the Saola was like a hunt for a unicorn. We believed it was out there. We couldn't be sure. We didn't know if or when we might ever get close to it, but we pursued it because of, in a sense, its magical, enchanting properties.
Yeah, exactly. On my best days, it's like trying to conserve a unicorn. On my worst days, it's like trying to conserve a unicorn. This is by far the largest animal, terrestrial animal in the world of certain existence. I mean, we're not talking about Yeti or Sasquatch or Loch Ness Monster. We know Saola exists. We know it's out there. We know approximately where. But it's by far the largest terrestrial animal in the world that has never been seen in the wild by a biologist. And that's extraordinary. That an animal weighing almost 200 pounds still hasn't been seen. And it's incredibly beautiful, as Bill said. So it is, in a way, like trying to conserve and find a unicorn.
I would add that there was a joke between us, and that was that back in the year 1250, when there seemed to be more unicorns in the world, everybody knew that the only person who could glimpse a unicorn had to be completely pure at heart.
Are you guys
knowing
pure
that?
Heart?
I don't know about a Robichaud, but I knew I wasn't going to get a glimpse.
Yeah. Well, he did see one in captivity, so he's partially pure in heart, I guess, right?
That's right, yeah.
I still have hope. I believe in purity by redemption.
Oh, there you go. Well, we'll see. Maybe he'll see the Saola then. You know, I have a question, and I don't want it to be flippant at all. The Saola could be extinct, right? I mean, they could all be gone.
And yet, why give up? The Saola still entrances many, many people, and the efforts show no sign of flagging.
Aren't you ever worried? I mean, I don't want to be cynical, but, you know, by discovering this animal, that's the wrong word, but by finding this animal and naming it and calling attention to it, do you ever worry you're part of endangering it too? I mean, rare things are stolen and destroyed on purpose. That's what people do. Don't you ever, like, feel like, hey, I saw this thing once, maybe I should just shut up and leave the thing alone?
Absolutely. One of the greatest constraints to Saola conservation is that nobody knows about it, including donors. I mean, this is perhaps now the most endangered large mammal in the world. It's far in greater proximity to extinction than tigers, elephants, species that get much greater attention and funding than Saola does. But whenever I write a grant proposal for Saola conservation, I have to spend half the proposal just telling the donor what a Saola is
real.
And telling them the story. But also, in sort of a beneficial obscurity, because mm-hmm. just as you said, on one hand, we need to raise awareness about Saola conservation with those who help conserve it. On the other hand, if you make the animal exceptionally famous in Laos, Vietnam, and China, you could inadvertently develop a demand for it.
Right.
I mean, the wealthy elite may say, oh, this animal only occurs in Laos and Vietnam, and, you know, it only occurs in my country, and it's almost extinct. I better go to, you know, a pair of its spectacular horns for my wall while there's still time. So we're very careful about this fine balancing act of bringing more attention to the animal's plight without also throwing away its disadvantage of it not having a demand in the wildlife trade.
Do you ever wish, for both of you, like, it seems a bit of an obsession, which I respect, and I know you're working very hard to do something here. Do you ever wish you never would have found it? You never would have been a part of this?
Think of this. Before 1992, the rest of the world didn't know that Saula existed. Now we do. But what other Saula-type creatures could
right.
still be out there hiding? That's why, that's one of the magical things for me about Saula, that it stands for all the other undiscovered elements of the biota of the world. And I love to think that there are more of them out there, not necessarily that they will be discovered, but just that they exist.
You know, I read your book. It's part of it affected me. I'm not sure why. I was kind of upset by part of it. And one of the things I was thinking about was, like, you could lose something. There could be an animal we lose somewhere in Borneo or in Africa or where we're talking about in Laos that you didn't even know existed. It could have gone extinct without us even knowing it, and it would be our fault that it went extinct. How do you even grasp a concept like that?
Well, it's difficult, and I think grief is part of a conscious life in this world. I mean, the more we love the world, the more we suffer grief when parts of it are destroyed. And yet, that grief opens our hearts more so that we can take in even more of the world. We can love the world even better. So it goes on and on in that way. And I think for me, the Saula and its vulnerability are right at the heart of that sort of moral learning point that is part and parcel of our life in this modern world.
Writer William DeBuys and conservation biologist William Robichaud. DeBuys' book about the Saula is called The Last Unicorn. Charles Monroe Cain talked with them. The Saula is the largest living animal in the world that has never been seen in the wild by a biologist. It's considered one of the most endangered species on the planet. Hey, thanks for listening. That's it for this episode, but there's more in our podcast feed. To sign up, visit iTunes or Stitcher or any other podcasting app, or check out our website at ttbook.org. To the best of our knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson and our technical director, Kirill Owen. And this week, we say goodbye to Craig Ely. He spent the past 2 years with us as a Mellon ACLS Public Humanities Fellow. He's moving on to the UW-Madison Center for the Humanities. Craig is a gifted producer, a wonderful colleague, and a good friend. We'll miss him. I'm Ann Strangechamps. Until next time.
PRI, Public Radio International.